Okay, guys, we might get started. Welcome to this cross-cell session. I'm Nicolette Rubenstein. I'm going to chair this afternoon. We have two presenters, James Hickey and Penny Butler. They're going to present for somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes and then leave time for questions. So I will just introduce them and then we will get going. So firstly, James, who's not Penny... James is a partner at Deloitte. He's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and has worked with Deloitte for over 15 years, and that's partly because he was part of its predecessor firm, Trowbridge. James leads Deloitte's actuarial advice services in the banking and mortgage sectors, and he also specialises in the provision of actuarial services to wealth management organisations. James is the lead author in the Deloitte Mortgage Report and the Reverse Mortgage Market Report, which is co-authored with Sequel, and he's authored various other publications. Moving on to Penny. Penny is an associate director also at Deloitte, based in Sydney. She's also a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and has worked with Deloitte for 10 years across both the Australian and UK firms. She's worked across a wide range of financial services clients, including life insurers, wealth management companies, and banks and other mortgage providers. Penny has specialist knowledge in life risk cross-sell and recently co-authored the life risk cross-sell article of the Deloitte Mortgage Report. So welcome to both of you, and I think they're both going to go over and do a tag team. Thank you.
Well, I think it's just too hard to walk from one side to the other all the time, but look, thanks everyone for coming along. So Penny and I will share today some of our recent experience in helping groups try to, I suppose... get their head around what the challenges around cross-sell and improve it. We're not going to say here's the magical solution because I don't think there is one, but we're just going to talk to you about how others have actually navigated through the landscape of how to assess what could be the best approach for their individual group. I thought I'd start off with a personal reflection. Recently, as the lead author of the mortgage report, I was going out to the market telling everyone how aggressive the banks were at the moment with their mortgage discounting below the standard variable rate. And I haven't seen if the RBA has moved yet on the cash rate, but we'll find out after this meeting probably. But so I went out to the market and I thought I'd go through a mortgage broker channel because I do a lot of work in the mortgage broking sector. And I went with a group that deliberately had tried to instigate a cross-sell of life risk into its advice-based model with its mortgage broker force. And I was pleasantly surprised because one of the first points of the discussion was obviously about my needs-based assessment, but they brought in very early on the insurance discussion. Do you have adequate insurance? What's your life, your TPD, your trauma, your income protection coverage that you've got? And for a mortgage broker to actually have the confidence to bring that up in a discussion with a potential, I was just looking to refinance, and that's a big thing because mortgage brokers traditionally focus on the mortgage. They don't often want to put at risk that mortgage sale or refinance by speaking about a topic which they may or may not have confidence in. So the fact that this broker was willing to speak to me about insurance goes to show that other groups in the marketplace, other than just traditional channels, are looking at how they can actually diversify their offering and their advice to consumers. I did ask the broker why she felt the need to discuss that with me, and she said, I believe it's a duty of care that I have for all customers when they're thinking about their mortgage needs, that I actually make sure that they're covered in case anything happens to them or their family members, which I thought was the right approach. It's a needs-based discussion rather than just trying to say to me, I've just been told to offer this product to you. Which is what a lot of, to be honest, some of the more direct offerings from banks tend to be is you've taken out a mortgage, now do you want insurance with that? It doesn't resonate as well. So that was just, I thought that was a really interesting observation note that there are new and emerging channels that are getting the need to bring this this insurance discussion into the broader context of bank lending. So what we'll cover today is a bit about, the first thing is the growing need to diversify. Diversify and cross-sell is certainly not new. I mean, every group's been trying to get the bank assurance model working correctly and so forth. What we're going to try to cover today is why do we actually think banks will be putting renewed energy and effort into getting that right over the next few years, and what will that challenge therefore produce to other players in the marketplace. And then Penny will talk through a case study around mortgage brokers, and then we'll try to wrap it up with a bit of her thoughts about what does that mean for bank branch channels around how they cross-sell. Obviously, there's been a shift from traditional towards newer channels. Certainly, I know some of you in this room are experts in the direct-to-consumer market, and that's certainly one which is, as we've seen from other presentations, taken off and is really growing quite rapidly at the moment. But we're certainly seeing an evolution in the life risk offerings from moving away from the tied agent-based model right through the bank branches to then the direct. The alliance model is really quite interesting at the moment, all the way through to, as I mentioned, mortgage brokers, aggregators, other professionals seeing the need to actually integrate insurance advice with broader advice. And I say that from the point of view that it is advice. I don't think a lot of these new entrants really believe it's a product flog. A lot of these new intermediaries do genuinely believe in the advice element of it, and that's an important distinction. So that whilst there's a number of, I suppose, offerings that could go with that, what we're going to talk about today is primarily the life risk component, but it's important to remember that general insurance, estate planning, wealth management, they're all other potential advice offerings that can go cap in hand with cross-sell. So the big question is, what will change? Why will the banks care about getting insurance advice and, for want of a better word, cross-sell up when they've never really focused on it too much in the past? Yes, they've always known it's a great thing to have multiple footholdings with a customer across multiple products, you know, improves retention and whatever, all those analyses that have shown that. But why are they going to change their desire and energy around this now? Probably a few reasons. One is that whilst they've had happy days pre-GFC with the total mortgage lending market growing at greater than 15% per annum, they're now in an environment where their primary revenue driver, being mortgages to Australian households, is growing at 5% per annum and is showing no signs of going back to double digit in the medium term. So their biggest engine for revenue growth is only growing at 5%, and that's even if they maintain market share in the market that's only growing 5%. That's why we're seeing aggressive discounting, aggressive price wars going on between all the majors to improve their market share of mortgage lending. But it also means that if they simply maintain market share in a market growing 5%, that's pretty hard to meet 15 to 20% return on equity targets that your investors may have, especially when Basel III comes in and puts your capital up. You need to find some other levers to get revenue growth in your overall business. So mortgages for a lot of banks, yes, it represents, say, 60 to 70% of their overall revenue. If that's only growing at 5%, they need the other parts of their bigger organisations to be firing and getting some returns coming through for them. A lot of people we go around the market say, well, won't bank lending growth return to 15% in the medium term, so it'll just be a short-term apparition? Well, I don't think it's the case, because you look at what led to bank lending growth growing at such high rates, double-digit rates, pre-GFC. It was a combination of, all the way back to deregulation through the 90s and 2000s, had the RMBS, residential mortgage-backed security market, really exploding, and non-bank competitors being able to access very cheap funding to compete with the majors. So you had a big supply of lending, you had a lot of activity, and also consumers had confidence, they were gearing up. They were quite happy to leverage up their debt serviceability ratios to quite high levels. I think going forward, there's no longer that cheap funding supply, and there's no longer that commitment by Australian households to gear up. So going forward, I think it will be a challenge for the banks to get much more, if you like, juice out of the mortgage engine, and they'll be looking to other areas to get the margins. So in terms of some of the cross-sell offerings, I mean, look, we've just put it simplistically here. Yes, there's obviously wealth, life risk, and what we've called general insurance. Yes, there's some others, no doubt, around estate planning and so forth. Certainly for banks, when they look at mortgage products, general insurance is often seen as the no-brainer. Take out a house and contents cover against the mortgage. It's, ironically, it's probably one of the least successful for the banks. One, because they know the consumer can just go home and Google and get half a dozen quotes within a few minutes of going onto a search engine around general insurance. So it's very hard to be price competitive. And even if you may get that customer to take the product out for the first year of their mortgage, within 12 months' time, when the renewal statement comes around, they'll go online again, or they'll go online to actually see what's the cheapest rate. So it's a commoditised product, relatively low margin, not a great amount of customer longevity in that. Wealth, absolutely, we believe that's wealth advice and packaging up some form of either scaled or more comprehensive advice around the investment and superannuation needs of the household at time of mortgage sale is absolutely makes sense. However, the challenge there is with the FOFA requirements, as was discussed in the plenary today, it doesn't necessarily make it an easy landscape to navigate around. And for a lot of bank branch staff, as well as brokers, how do they navigate through FOFA? As I think Paul Barrett said today, how do you actually offer some form of incentive or remuneration arrangement which actually aligns the interest of your bank branch to go and have that discussion versus the actual FOFA requirements. So it's a difficult one to navigate. We see the biggest opportunities around life risk for two reasons. One is that obviously when a consumer takes out a mortgage, it's a big life-changing event. It's the biggest debt they've taken on. It's a perfect time to have a discussion about income protection and life risk, all the reasons actuaries know. But the other one, which CFOs of banks know, is that it's a highly profitable business. So life risk, when you can earn 20% of premium as your profit margin, that's a pretty attractive margin, especially when you get pretty good persistency rates if it comes through an advice-based sale as part of that. So it's a highly attractive margin-generating part of the business. We actually had the CFO of a major bank in just a few weeks ago, and we're chatting with him, and he said one thing they learnt during the GFC was that it's great to be in life insurance because it's counter-cyclical. So whilst their mortgage business suffered because of the funding costs and so forth, their wealth management business suffered because of investment returns and uncertainty, the life risk sales were going really, really well. So I think they see the benefit in this holistic mix across their portfolios, and I think they want to bring it in and more ingrain it within those other engines of wealth and banking, bring the life risk across. So I'll hand over to Penny. She'll chat a bit about the broking landscape. But we're just trying to say it's important to also put in context, whilst we're talking about the broking landscape, we certainly appreciate that the direct market is a lot bigger than just, let's say, what we'll talk about now, the broking market. You've got, obviously, banks doing direct cross-sell out to their membership or their client base. You've got direct-to-consumer models which are out there triggering the education and awareness of consumers in the broader marketplace about life risks. So this is just one subset of a broader degree of cross-sell and channels that are being used to try to reach the consumer. I'll hand over to Penny.
Thanks, James. It's an interesting subset as well. So for those of you who don't know a lot about the broker market, we've got the top 10 up there. Some of those will probably be names that you've heard of, Mortgage Choice, Aussie. Others may not be. They're divided into two groups as well. You've got franchise groups, such as Mortgage Choice, who have a bit more control over their brokers because they're a franchise. Then you've got other groups that are just an aggregator, so they provide a platform for all the tools that the broker would need, but you know, you could walk into Joe Blogg's Mortgage Broking and not know that he's an AFG broker. However, all of the mortgage brokers are subject to the industry issues that we've got up there. It's consolidation, a slowing finance market coupled with reduced commissions and increased compliance. So one of the challenges that these mortgage broking groups have is how do they avoid being purely price takers on mortgage sales? So they're using three main strategies really to diversify. First one is to move along the mortgage supply chain. So a number of the groups have launched white label mortgage products so that they can try and get some of the additional margins in the product design space. I mean, that's got its own challenges at the moment. But you've also then got deepening the lending offerings. So a number of the groups have moved into other forms of finance, so personal loans, car loans. But then the third, and where we'll focus today, area that they're moving into to get the other margins is to wealth and insurance cross-sell. So if you think about it, a broker, or a really good broker, has this trusted advisor relationship with their clients in a relatively short period of time. So you've got your strengthening KYC, know your client requirements under NCCP, a customer who's really, you know, at a point of change in their life when they're taking out a mortgage. And you've got this broker as the person there who's really ideally placed to offer some other financial products to meet some needs. So successful broker groups have realised the strength of their offering is around this advice, and they're moving in various degrees into financial advice models. Now, most large aggregator groups offer some form of general insurance products and life risk products, and you've also got groups such as Aussie that are moving into the wealth space. James, did you want to talk quickly?
Comments on this one, Penny. So we did a survey of industry professionals in the banking sector, and including broker groups themselves. And we asked on the your left-hand side there what cross-sell areas are most likely to be successful for brokers. I suppose against what I said earlier, most said general insurance, packaging, home and contents, but that's probably a no-brainer. it was encouraging to see, I think it's 30% there saying life risk insurance, with about 20% saying financial planning. But as Penny mentioned earlier, yeah, this is a part of the market where these are advice-based intermediaries. They know that their primary revenue, which is from the mortgage, is going to slow down because of commission changes and the slowing market, and they need to get more revenue or diversify their advice offering to replace that lost revenue. So they are actively looking at life. As Penny said, Aussie and Mortgage Choice are about to offer a scaled advice financial planning part of their business. So all these groups are looking at how to diversify because their livelihood actually depends upon it. On the right-hand side, we asked, no doubt a topical issue for IFAs in the wealth sector, but we said to brokers, will a fee-for-service regime come in for brokers? Now, I was disappointed when no one said, yes, definitely. I think it's a bit of head in the sand stuff if they think that they won't have to ultimately move to some form of fee-for-advice model. I don't think it's got the same issues as what was put forward for the fee-for-service requirements in the wealth sector around the conflict of interest, but certainly for consumers to accept that the interaction with a broker is actually a valuable service, they need to start to integrate a fee-for-service model going forward. And with that, to justify the advice they give, I think they'll look to actually bring in broader debt servicing and debt advisory discussions, of which insurance will certainly be one of them.
Thanks. So talking back to cross-sell, if we move slides, life risk really should be an easy cross-sell. You know, it seems like the writing's on the wall. You've got a customer taking out the largest debt of their life, probably a little understanding of the risk that they're taking on. We've heard today, yesterday, and just in general about underinsurance in life risk, mortgage debt levels all-time high, brokers spending more time in front of their clients, a variety of products are available, and commissions, whilst they're not getting as much as an IFA would get, you know, the commissions aren't too bad. If you write, if you have a conversion rate of 30% of your mortgage sales for a typical broker, that's like getting an extra one or two sales per month. So it's not peanuts. But it's just, no one's got it completely right. We've got a number of different models that exist in the market. They move from sort of a no-referral, tick-and-flick type model where a broker just provides the customer information to the insurer. The insurer's call centre then calls the customer and potentially makes a sale and does all of the work there. You've got referral models where a broker might just talk a bit about the concept of insurance but then directs the customer to contact the insurer. You move into the no advice space where the broker's done a bit of training. They know a bit about the product, but they only have one product that they can offer and they can't sell anything other than this one product. Moving into general advice where a broker can provide broad advice for what people in your situation might need. Again, they've done extra training for that. Or moving up into full advice, which is like being a financial planner. And you can see that various broker groups have linked with various insurers along this scale here. And I should say as well that various broker groups have often tried more than one point along this scale as well. But one thing that we're finding, and we've talked a lot about it in this conference, is I guess getting into the hearts and minds of the customer. So it's not just about the product, it's about really getting the customer engaged in why they need this. But in this case as well, it's also about getting into the hearts and minds of the broker. And why on earth should a broker move away from these mortgage sales into doing cross-sell of life insurance or any other insurance for that matter? The things that we've sort of come across that really need to be hit are motivation. So the broker gets that this is a duty of care. He cares about the client. Maybe it's commission-based motivation, but anyway, they see themselves as more than just a mortgage broker. There's support in selling the product. So, you know, they've been properly trained. They understand the product. They understand the process. It's a fairly smooth process. They trust the product. This is a big one. They actually trust that the product is right, or it is a good product, that claims will be paid, and that their reputation isn't going to be damaged by selling this product. And the thing that we found when interviewing various brokers is that there's really distinct individual views as to whether a generic product is good enough, so at least the client has something, or whether they should be recommending the best possible product for their individual client, so choice of a panel. So it's really distinct views. James, you want to talk about some bank models?
Yeah. Now look, Penny, just to your point earlier about the distinct views and sort of flick back to where Penny was saying here that the trust in the product, and you look at the different models, the tick and flick model at the top is pretty much a one size fits all, often a uniform price based upon age and gender. So the brokers, at least they believe that's probably a model where they think at least my customer's got something, which is better than nothing, versus those groups like Smartline who have gone a full advice model. A lot of their brokers say, no, we actually want to have the customised, even if it needs to be individually underwritten, life insurance products. We know that our customer's getting the best price they possibly can and not just paying the price of the average. So different groups will have different motivations because of their brokers that are actually part of that group.
Different brokers have different motivations.
They do, yeah, yes. And I'll say a group like Smartline's interesting because they, it's actually supported from head office. So they actually publish, if you like, a name and shame across their broker groups every month at least, where they publish not only the amount of settlements that are sold across all the brokers, and their individual name is actually on the list given to all the brokers as the franchisee member saying, here's your settlements for the month. It also says, here's your life risk cross-sell, here's your general insurance cross-sell for that month. And it's a bit of a... They use it as a motivating tool, and it is. I mean, these people are competitive. They like to see if they're the biggest writer of mortgages, but they rank well out of the top 10 for writing life insurance, but their colleague is up at number one. It's a bit of a motivating factor to actually understand what are their colleagues doing, why are they so successful, yet I'm good at mortgages but not at the cross-sell. So that's one approach that group, for instance, has taken. Moving on to bank models, what does that mean about, you know, what's the opportunities for banks? I think, you know, Paul Barrett put it well this morning at the plenary about how do you actually engage some of the bank-based staff and sales force to actually understand broader, rather than being transaction-based people, they're actually advice-based branch staff. And I think going forward, the bank branch of the future, which a lot of the big four are talking about now, is going to be moving away from being a transactional hub, because a lot of people can do their transactions online or increasingly via mobile or whatever they've got. And the branch will be more of a relationship centre or hub for people to go to and actually get advice-based information. But the challenge with bank models, unlike brokers make their livelihood on getting that mortgage sale or getting that piece of advice and building up that relationship with the customer. Often bank staff in the branch don't have that same motivating force around, you know, this is my livelihood here. I mean, they'll often be paid a salary irrespective of whether the person takes out the product or not. So how do you deal with that different motivation, as Penny mentioned earlier? Look, some of them, I think, are making good progress. I mean, there's always been trial and errors on this. Do you put a financial planner into the branch to try to get wealth, you know, cross-sell with the mortgages? I'm sure CBA Nicolette's probably been a few different iterations of that concept and approach. I'm sure all the banks have. You know, others are struggling with the question being, are you actually going to be a manufacturer of the product, or do you actually want to be a distributor? Where are you best placed with that? You know, how are the traditional channels going to sit alongside the newer channels? And, you know, at pre and post point of sale. So who gets in there first with their advice-based offering with that customer when they come in? So, you know, there's got to be a clear distribution strategy for the bank branch. How do all these different... If they're different people with these different skill sets for the advice, how do they all sit alongside each other and get to the customer at the right point in time, or sit in the queue, as it may be, in terms of when's their right time to speak to the customer? You know, when we thought about empowering the branch, we thought, okay, what's some of the requirements here given the branch-specific dynamics? Look, education was certainly key, and I think that came through in the plenary this morning. How do you educate the branch staff around the needs-based discussion which they can have with customers or potential customers when they come in? I think a lot of groups are focused on the technical knowledge of branch staff, but in our sort of analysis we've done, technical understanding of the product is only a small requirement. You actually need to understand what's the motivating force of the customer, what's the needs-based awareness discussion you need to have. That's the bigger role for education. Doing a lot of role plays, scripted role plays with frontline branch staff around that's very important. Make sure they put the customer first rather than the product first. It is quite critical as well, rather than just being seen as a provider of product. They're actually there to solve the customer's needs. Support from head office, obviously, is critical. I thought it was interesting this morning about remuneration and how much you can actually, you know, incentivise the front line around lifting their input around advice and broader advice in the branch, as opposed to just being have their KPIs around transaction-based metrics. We've seen groups, more successful groups, have moved towards having revenue-based branch targets rather than just volume-based branch targets to get the right behaviour, particularly around the price that's actually being offered on some of these offerings. Appropriate products, I don't know whether the problem is really in the products for life risk. I think most groups are working towards or already have a straight through underwriting process for a lot of their direct life risk products. Those can be eminently applied at the branch, so I don't know whether it's the product that's the issue. It's more the education and awareness. And the last point, though, is timeliness. This is probably where a few groups have definitely gotten it wrong, in that it's the traditional do you want fries with that sort of discussion, where they don't want to rock the boat in terms of the mortgage discussion. The whole mortgage discussion will happen end to end. The customer goes through a settlement. The loan is then settled. The money's transferred. Within 24 hours, the bank phones them up and says, oh, by the way, now do you want insurance with that? You've missed the boat. I mean, the person's been through the needs-based assessment. They've got the money in their bank account. They've moved into the new home. They're beyond now really thinking about insurance. You've got to tackle that right up front when they first come in and talk to you about, I'm thinking about moving house, or I'm looking to buy a house in this sort of area. That's the time to bring in the discussion about insurance and other potential advice-based discussions. If you leave it till the end, it just becomes a product flog. If you bring it in at the front, it actually becomes part of the advice discussion and seen as valuable advice in that process. So timeliness is quite critical. And even those groups we saw earlier that use the tick and flick model, where if the customer comes to the broker at the start of the discussion, the broker will say, do you want to hear about insurance? And they'll tell them why, and the person will say, yeah, I want to hear about insurance. And then that goes to the insurance company. They then have an outbound call centre that then calls that customer. The decay factor, if you want to call it that, in terms of timeliness of response is quite critical. If you get back to them in 72 hours or beyond, they've forgotten what the hell you're talking to them about 72 hours ago. If you get back to them within a couple of hours, great, it's still in their mind. They still remember that conversation. So it's quite critical, the whole timeliness, and when you talk to someone about their needs. So then pushing the boundaries, a bit about thoughts for actuaries. Segmentation, I think that's come up in a lot of discussions around these, some of these concurrents. But with that, I mean, if you think about a bank and where a bank has a significant advantage, it's around the data that it's got, particularly, I would say, the non-insurance data it's got about individuals. A lot of insurance divisions purely focus upon the, what's unique to the insurance data. If you actually go and do a screen scrape or a transaction account or credit card scrapes of all your customers over a period of time, and there was a concurrent previously that talked about that for one of the big four banks, you get to see all the transactions going through that credit card. You get to see when they've suddenly gone out to is it Babies Galore? Is that what it's called now? Or some other Babyography? I think it's changed its name. But you get to see when they go out there and buy the pram. And you think, okay, well, that person's buying a pram. Or maybe they're about to have a child. You'd hope so. It wouldn't do it for fun. Maybe. But that gives you a great insight into the fact, right, well, they're only a few months away potentially. Now's a good time to maybe do a proactive reach out to them, have that more customised discussion with them about where they actually are in their life stage, rather than working off the assumption that if they're a married couple between the age of 30 to 36, all right, I've got to go and talk to them about life risk, when they may not even be having kids or they may already have kids. At least this is a more customised discussion. But leveraging the broader data asset that the bank has available to go and screen some of the credit card transactions or broader payment transactions, I think is quite a valuable thing, which a few groups are getting, but I see it as a way in which that can be better fed back to the front line around some of these timely needs-based discussions. Merging of products, I think Pennyworth's sort of seeing a bit of this in terms of make sure that the more integrated it can be, that comes with the bundling, but the more integrated it can be, the more seamless it is in terms of it being seen as one piece of packaged fee or price that you're actually being paid for, both the mortgage and the insurance, that's great. If it's seen as two distinct pieces, then sometimes that's a bit of a hassle for the consumer, especially if there's different processes, particularly if there's different brands and different touch points they have to go through to actually get each of those pieces. You want to have it all synchronised through the one touch point. And then finally, a lot of people, when they think about cross-sell, particularly think about just for new applicants or new customers coming in. I mean, a lot of it can be your existing customers. And yes, there's always a traditional bank mail-out campaign to your existing customer base, right? We'll send the direct mail campaign out. We'll get our, maybe 1% or 2% response rate. Isn't that great? This is more about being far more fact-based and data-driven in terms of who you're going to target, get a lot bigger uptake. So like I said before, doing linking to the transaction account behaviour of that individual to actually really see where they are in their life cycle, that behavioural-based trigger point, and go and have a more tailored and meaningful discussion. I know Nicolette, we were talking earlier about the... some of you may have come along to the concurrent yesterday that NAB, that the marketing person from NAB mentioned that the best campaign they never launched or never had, and what sort of success they had. But that was because I was having individual tailored discussions about that exact individual household's actual needs and what their actual balances were, and having a real succinct discussion rather than talking in generic terms, oh, are you about to enter this life cycle stage? Give us a call on this number. So the more specific you can get with your customers, the more likelihood of success you'll have. That's the end of our presentation. So,
okay. Yep.
Happy to take questions.
Got a few minutes for questions. excuse me. If you've got a question, can you go to the mic and introduce yourself first?
I'm sure someone like Andrew Gale would have questions for a group like this, Andrew.
He might know all the answers.
He probably would.
Okay. Well, in the meantime,
give me time to think.
Ashley Pumperman here. Enjoyed the presentation. With the packaging of products and sort of different service lines, where do you see potential mis-selling risks?
Yes, you do need to navigate the landscapes pretty carefully. And I mean, a challenge out there is you've got obviously FOFA and FSRA on the wealth side. You've got NCCP, which is obviously on the mortgage side. So you've actually got to navigate through a few different regulatory regimes, a few different regulators that take an interest in these various aspects. So ASIC certainly will have a look at how that's done. And I mean, they did a paper a little while ago about the bundling of life risk with mortgages all as the one sort of loan amount when you've got maybe a limited term life cover but effectively being paid for by a 25-year amortising mortgage. And you know, the consumer may not be aware they're actually paying interest for 20-odd years when they still don't have the cover. That sort of concern that ASIC has. So you do need to be very careful about that and navigate your way through that. But again, you've got to look at that with also innovation and say, well, okay, what are the areas where we can potentially innovate to actually make it easy for the consumer, but also make sure we're not falling foul of any of the regulatory requirements there, particularly the consumer-based ones. That's right. And look, you can't hope that banks will change all of their frontline staff to commission-based sort of models, which is, you know, obviously that drives brokers, or a fee-based model which drives brokers. Certainly the branch staff need to be salary-based, but there needs to be that volume upside, and what's the KPI that's linked to that. So obviously a purely volume-based one may not be the greatest, because if you've got great volume but then you've got 50% cancellation from inception within 12 months, that's not a great outcome for the consumer, and that's where ASIC would get concerned about. But if it's based around a proper needs-based process that you can validate and document and show that you've been through the right process, that's the way to do that.
Yeah. Sorry, just out of interest, when you went to your mortgage broker and they're recommending insurance, are they licensed?
They have done the varying. It depends on where they are, Nicolette, on that sort of spectrum of tick and flick versus full advice.
Yeah.
But this broker had been through a full RG146 requirement, so yes, they were licensed.
And is that quite common now for? Is that common for brokers to have gone through RG146?
No, some groups are moving more towards that way. It'd be more common for them to be sort of at the no advice level, so in the middle they can only offer this one product. And I guess sort of getting back to the point there as well, interestingly, some really didn't care too much about the commissions. I mean, they thought, yeah, we get a little bit, but it's more that this is the duty of care, this is my client. I feel I should have something to offer them. So it wasn't so much about the commissions there.
So Smartline's an interesting group. Smartline was one down to the full advice sort of end. I don't think they allow their brokers a tick and flick, nor do they allow them to do just a one general advice only.
They do. They have the no advice.
That as well. No advice and the full advice. But they realised a lot of their brokers actually wanted to move up the advice chain and wanted to go up towards a full advice so they could actually get the best tailored offering for their customer. That does involve some licensing and training, but they went through a financial planning dealer group to license their brokers on their behalf.
Cool. Okay, any more questions?
Andrew. Okay, trying to think about a question. Good.
I think one of the other compelling reasons for doing cross-sell, ultimately, apart from looking after client needs, is there's, I think, a reasonable amount of evidence around that if you've got different categories of product ownership by the one client, then the retention on those clients is much, much stronger, and it's actually the retention which is the big profit driver in due course.
Yeah.
Have you done any work on that recently in terms of insights in that space?
Yes, we have, and one of the other things I do with banks is help them around retention propensity models, and one thing we definitely bring in is multiple product holdings and the type of product it is that they've got as well, because that does significantly influence the propensity rate to refinance or otherwise. But I think what it comes down to is not necessarily they've got multiple products, but they've just got a deeper relationship with the institution, and they probably have the right advice across a lot of those products. So they've got a more meaningful relationship with the institution rather than just having multiple products. So, you know, you look at some groups which may have been fortunate because they've been the amalgamation of a lot of regional-based bank and insurer and whatever may be coming together, and yes, they can claim they have a higher footholding of products per customer. That doesn't actually mean they've actually been advised on those multiple cross-holdings. That's pure luck they've come together that way. I don't think that drives better retention. I think it's when you actually have it as an advice-based, holistic offering. But you're right, that's where the back-ended value most certainly is. Yeah.
Okay. I think we will wrap it up there. We've got afternoon tea now, and if you could fill in your feedback forms and join me in thanking Penny and James.
Thank you.